Well, good morning to you, and welcome to Palm Sunday services. what a picture that brings to mind of Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem. And all that in the wider context of a long history of expectation, which includes the book of Isaiah that we've been studying. Okay, let's find that. So we've concentrated on chapter 53 for several weeks now, and I'm at least for the moment moving on. Although suspicion is going to be kind of like Romans. It's going to be something that we occasionally revisit and look at some more. And that's not to say that if you feel like I haven't addressed anything that's of concern to you, feel free to bring it up. I just don't want to exhaust you with over-treatment or repetition. So I'm going to start chapter 54 this morning. So, just a word or two from John Oswald here in commentary to begin this. It's back. Okay. He says, chapters 54 and 55 are a lyrical announcement of salvation and a call to participate in and rejoice in its reality. As many commentators have pointed out, there is little direct connection between 52:13 through 53:12, which is basically all of chapter 53, and the few verses from 52, which should be considered with it as a literary unit. So there's a little direct connection between the section we've just looked at and these next two chapters. That is, there are few, if any, repetitions of that passage's themes and no direct references. Okay? So a lot of times, we look for connections as we progress through a given work in the Bible. We generally expect, and I don't know if it's a Western thing or it's just a thing, but we expect there to be development in thought, right? So you lay a foundation for an idea or concept or a topic, and then you develop it as you go along. That's typically how we write. That's typically how teachers teach us to write. In some cases, of course, the books of the Bible are collections of things that don't do that. You know, you don't really expect that in the Psalms. When you go from one psalm to another, it could even be a different author, and very often a different topic. But certainly in Paul's letters, when you're writing an epistle, as he did, you get that kind of development. And quite often in the Gospels, we do see connections and the importance of looking at where you start and how it progresses. So when you have a book like Isaiah, which was written a very long time ago, you're trying to see, okay, is this a development? Are there things here which represent a flow of logic, a flow of thought? And certainly the passages that we had just read have been shocking. That seems to be one of Isaiah's main points in the way he laid it out. This is not expected. This is not what you see coming. When you anticipate the arm of God being revealed, you don't expect it in this way. You don't expect the servant to be experiencing things like this, being the one who is approved of God. And so then there is certainly a desire and sort of an attempt to see, is there any way that this is connected? Can we find that? And so here is Oswald's attempt to do that. He says, yet if one omits that poem, speaking of Isaiah 53 and associated verses, and tries to move directly from 52:12 to 54:1, the change of atmosphere is hard to explain. Now, we often get in the mode of microscope analysis, right? When we do scripture, we want to dig deep. We want to see what the layers are. And sometimes it's a totally different mindset to back up and say, okay, are there things going on a bigger scale here? And it takes a lot more study to do that, and you sort of have to reimmerse yourself. How many of you remember Isaiah 52:12 this morning? Well, you're like me, okay? So you got to go back and read that stuff, right? And remember it, and look for things like tone. So tone is not what's specifically stated, but attitude, right? What does this say about what this writer is thinking and behind the scenes, so to speak? And so we really don't have, I don't think, the time, attention span, or energy to do that here this morning. So we're going to take some of his analysis here, and if you have a problem with it, you can go back and look at it for yourself another time. But this is what he says. He says, even though 52:7-12 is somewhat more lyrical than 49:14 through 52:6, it is still continuing the tone of disputation and exhortation that characterizes that section as a whole. Israel is being called on to believe that it can be restored to God. Okay? In chapters 54 and 55, that is all changed. So, in what we're about to read, he says it's a different tone with regard to this perspective. Here, Israel is restored, in the mind of the writer at least, and is called to bask in that reality. If nothing intervenes between the former section and this section, the shift is unaccountable. But if the intervening passage is understood as an expression of the means by which a restored relationship between God and his people is possible, then the change in atmosphere is entirely understandable. Okay, so that's his attempt to try to create a flow of logic through these chapters, which Isaiah doesn't make a point of by making direct connections in the text. Okay, with that introduction then, let's take a look at chapter 54 and what is said there. So, as often in Isaiah, we plunge right into metaphorical language, which is a very poignant expression of the mentalities and feelings of this people in an ancient time, and which we perhaps have to look over their shoulder and say, okay, yeah, I see what he's talking about there, because things have changed somewhat in regard to some of these issues. He says, sing, O barren, thou that didst not bear. Sing, break forth into singing, and cry aloud, thou that didst not travail with child. For more are the children of the desolate than the children of the married wife, saith the Lord. Okay, so this is based on a world where if you were a woman and didn't have children, you felt personally responsible in some way, and you felt that God was punishing you for it. That's kind of sad all by itself, isn't it? We now realize there are any number of reasons why you might not have children. Some of them represent serious physical problems that an individual woman has no control over. And so that is a sad thing when you see some of the experiences of some of the women in the Old Testament who suffered greatly because of the fact that they couldn't bear. On the other hand, it creates a great opportunity for God to use this situation to illustrate his power, because if in fact you can't have children, certainly in the ancient world, there wasn't a thing in the world you could do about it. You know, there wasn't, you couldn't go to a fertility doctor. Well, there you could of sorts, but not a good thing. There was no explanation. It's just here I am, right? And God has not blessed me. And so those instances, Sarah, Hannah, Elizabeth in the New Testament, those instances where God intervenes in a situation that has gone on for years and been a great trial and sorrow in the lives of individual women, those situations become beautiful metaphors of the power of God to bring fertility into a world that was barren. And so this verse, of course, is playing on that situation. It is God saying, sing. Okay, the last thing on the mind of a barren woman, song. Cry aloud. Things are going to change. Now, the rest of that verse, it's not perhaps immediately apparent what he's saying. He says, for more the children of the desolate than the children of the married wife. What does that mean in your mind? Do you know what that says?
Mine says, for the children of the desolate one will be more than the children of her who is married.
Okay, and what's the contrast, though?
That she was barren, but she's going to have even more of... What's that, married? I don't understand. It makes more sense that it was than the one who's not barren.
So the contrast is the one who has a husband and the one who doesn't, the one whose husband has forsaken her, which is not what you really totally expect from the first half of the verse. And the picture here is of God as the faithful husband, faithful to his people, and he will be there when others aren't. Now, it's interesting. This is a passage which is used by the Apostle Paul in Galatians, a direct quote. In Galatians 4:27, as he's arguing there with the hypothetical Galatian reader, well, the real reader, but in writing to them, he's not talking to them by name, to the church, he's countering this notion that they have latched onto, that they need to be connected to the law of the Jews in order to truly be followers of Jesus. And so it's quite an application that Paul uses there. It's almost, in a sense, he's using these Jewish scriptures against other Jewish practices to speak of the freedom, as he calls it, that we gain through Christ. And but anyway, that's another passage. But it is notable that this is one of the verses that he quotes directly. In this case, this verse introduces several here which speak of a change in status for the barren woman. So he says, first of all, rejoice. In verse 2, he says, enlarge the place of thy tent. Let them stretch forth the curtains of thy habitations. Spare not, lengthen thy cords, and strengthen thy stakes. Okay, so apparently in the ancient East, there was the tradition that basically the woman was responsible for pitching and maintaining the tent. And so this is talk of remodeling. Okay, this is making things bigger. enlarge, stretch out those curtains and lengthen your cords, strengthen your stakes, you know, as you increase the size of the tent. It's like making the sail bigger on a ship, right? Because when the wind comes, you better have something to hold it. So you're going to need deeper stakes, and you're going to have longer cords. But it's a picture of progress, a picture of expansion, the need for more room, because there is going to be more offspring. For thou shalt break forth on the right hand and on the left, and thy seed shall inherit the Gentiles and make the desolate cities to be inhabited. Now, we keep getting hints in Isaiah of this time whenever God's reach into the world will be beyond his chosen people. That is, those who are of the seed of Abraham by the flesh, and will include the Gentiles. And this is certainly a very plain expression of that. And I don't know about you, but when I read a passage like that, it moves me, because I realize, hey, that's me. Mm-hmm. You know.
And that he had that in mind all along.
And so this, the offspring that he is connecting to here is not just of the house of Jacob, but the Gentiles as well are part of that need for enlarging the tent, strengthening the stakes. Fear not, for thou shalt not be ashamed, neither be thou confounded, for thou shalt not be put to shame. For thou shalt forget the shame of thy youth, and shalt not remember the reproach of thy widowhood anymore. Okay, so he introduces another metaphor there. Hadn't really spoken of being a widow in this passage, but that was another incredible crisis in the life of a woman in the ancient world, to lose the security and sustenance of a husband. So I think it's a lesson to us, though, the fact that Isaiah, in his lavish portrayal of ideas, doesn't hesitate to jump metaphors all the time. You might think at first, well, why did he say that? Am I supposed to draw some conclusions about, I mean, if God is the husband, he didn't die, you know? But I'm thinking, no, don't. You don't have to go there. This is another very strong image that communicates this change in status, from being ashamed, from being defeated, from being desolate, to being blessed. And we sometimes struggle with that kind of fluid treatment of ideas. I One of the things that I woke up to this morning was a question on the radio by some lady who wanted to know that in the New Testament, in the parable of the virgins, what was it that the foolish virgins bought? They bought oil, right? They went and bought. Well, what was it they bought? And the person answering the question, well, he was convinced that they bought false religion is what they bought. Well, the point of the parable is not that. The point is they weren't ready, right? They weren't prepared. You don't have to assign a numerical value to each thing. Obviously, it's not numerical, but I mean, you don't have to do that kind of thing. That's not how parables work, and that's not how prophecy works. And so here, I think we can recognize that God's not saying he died or anything like that. This is another powerful metaphor which speaks along the same lines of childlessness. And so then he continues, "For thy maker is thine husband." Okay? And he's the maker in more than one way. Certainly we understand that he created all things. He's the maker like that. But as well, he created the nation of Israel. He made them what they were. He brought them out of captivity, brought them out of oblivion in a kind of rebirth into a nation. And so it has a deep meaning. Thy maker is also thine husband. The Lord of hosts is his name, and thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. The God of the whole earth shall he be called. So what a movement emotionally from this barren, widowed, desolate, shameful state to this perspective of being united with my Redeemer, the God of the whole earth, the Lord of hosts. That's a lot of movement in just a few verses, isn't it? So then, you can't help but then reflect a little bit on 53. And wonder what all's going through Isaiah's mind in terms of the connection. I think we understand at times that there are things that the prophets experienced, things that they saw, that they didn't fully understand. They reported what they saw. I believe it's Paul in the New Testament that speaks of them not being made perfect without us. That is to say, the things that were perhaps initiated or foreseen in those days were not fully understood until they came into reality. And we know for a fact in reading the Gospels that the children of Israel that had inherited all these prophecies weren't expecting Jesus to come as he came. It is a matter of fact that his revelation had to be explained and connected for them to many of these passages. And so I think we ought to maybe keep that in mind in realizing that Isaiah writes a passage like this without making any direct connection to the redemption that he describes in the previous chapter, except to say that the Lord did it. The Lord is my Redeemer, is your Redeemer. And that, I don't know, that satisfies my mind. So, he continues, "For the Lord hath called thee as a woman forsaken and grieved in spirit, and a wife of youth, when thou wast refused, saith thy God. For a small moment have I forsaken thee, but with great mercies will I gather thee. In a little wrath I hid my face from thee for a moment, but with everlasting kindness will I have mercy on thee, saith the Lord thy Redeemer." Now the word here in verse 8, which is translated kindness, is a word in Hebrew. Hesed is how it looks, but if you say it properly, you put a noisy kind of sound on the front of it. And I don't want you to think I'm trying to spit, so I won't do that right now. But that is kind of how you say it. This is an interesting word. And let me give you some commentary on that to maybe enlarge your understanding. Oswald says, "No single English word can encompass all the connotations of this Hebrew word." And so here we go again. Oh, joy. We can't say it in English just like they said it, so we kind of got to figure it out.
Well, kindness is, mine says everlasting love. Is that the right spot that you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay.
And so it's a word which can be translated love. So no single word can do it. But its basic idea is of passionate loyalty, especially of a superior to an inferior. In its basic usage, it refers to the obligations of covenant. But in the biblical experience of God, it comes to express that loyalty which goes far beyond any legal obligation in a passionate concern for the well-being of the other. It was this that God has for his people, which expresses itself in grace, mercy, unfailing love, kindness, and several other similar English words. Okay, so it seems that it would be roughly parallel to the Greek agape, although in this passage the Septuagint didn't translate it that way. Let's just, out of interest, take a look at how the Septuagint translated it. The Greek word used in the Septuagint here is a form of eleos, which is usually translated mercy. So perhaps the Hebrew word can't be translated fully by one into Greek either. It's used again in verse 10. Let's just see how it's translated there. That kindness is how it's translated in English.
One's compassion both times.
Compassion both times, okay. And so going to the Septuagint, yeah, it's mercy, which the Greek word can be translated compassion as well. Mercy, pity, clemency. So sometimes when we say mercy, that has a forensic flavor, so kind of a courtroom type thing that compassion doesn't have. Compassion is more compassionate, human, right? So it, But I think if you know, if we think about God in that position, I mean, that's a very appealing thing. It's a very humbling thing. It speaks of his great heart of love. I mean, at the end of the day, that's how we analyze it, right? He loves us. That's why he treats us that way. That's why he is disposed toward us in that way. So don't ever get the notion that love is a New Testament concept and justice is all Old Testament. We have compassion here, don't we? He is a God of compassion and always has been. Yes?
Almost like this phrase, though roughly, to agape is a little bit more visceral. You kind of get it walked out a little bit more and explained a little bit more in the Old Testament, because you get to see how it works. How it works in history.
Although if you think about the love of Jesus and how he lives that out, certainly that gives you a pretty poignant picture of compassion as well, doesn't it? It was so many times it speaks of him being moved by the crowds and the needs of the people around him. So we see that in him.
It's so unhuman, though. Like the agape love and even this fierce level of loyalty, it's just not what comes naturally to humans. It's very godlike. We're supposed to emulate, of course, but even in the Old Testament, it's like, man, I just can't fathom what's happening if I have the power to, like, over and over again. It's just... Even Jesus was so much more patient and loving.
Yes. So would you say that in terms of human beings and what's natural, there is a degree of natural tendency that I think God sort of ties into to illustrate for us? There is a tendency naturally for us to be compassionate toward our own kids. Right, for usually, if you have somebody that's not majorly messed up, that tends to be the nature of things. And then God tries to communicate his attitude toward us by connecting into that with Father, a Father image, which should be a positive thing naturally. But then, you know, when you think about his interactions with the nation of Israel and the way they rejected him and turned aside after other desires, that's not natural to respond to that with care, you know, with a desire to be reunited. It's like, I'm done with you would be our position. Yeah, and of course, I think Jesus kind of drives that point home when he uses the term love in connection with how we should be disposed toward our enemies. Right? Enemies. Well, the very word conjures up in our mind walls of defense. Right? If you got enemies, you build a castle. If you got enemies, you find ways to protect yourself against them so they don't hurt you. And so by his suggesting that, well, you know, if you're going to be like your Father in heaven, then you need to have, when you put it as a commandment, thou shalt love thine enemies, it has a totally different flavor than you need to be compassionate toward them. You need to care about them. Otherwise, it's almost like, okay, I've got to like everybody even if they're behaving like the devil. Well, God doesn't like that either. But even though they behave like the devil, he has compassion on them. He wants to save them. He wants to change them. So that's a different flavor of meaning.
Isn't it true that he sees what they could be? And that always helps me if I'm near to
if I can just somehow, what you could be, what you're missing, rather than, you know, don't go on the defense, but just, oh, what you're missing, what you're hurting yourself. And that helps me.
Yes.
It demands that we think about more than what's going on the surface.
Yes.
Compassion does, where command, I've been thinking about this recently, it's kind of where the emotions and the brain meet, because you can command me to love all day, but and I can't even, okay, fine, I'll love. But there's another level that you don't, if you don't feel it, if it's not what naturally flows from you, if it's, okay, fine, I'll love, it doesn't work in command form. And so the compassion side of it forces you to look beneath the surface, like, okay, why are they acting this way? And then you can have compassion. It's like, oh, are there these things that kind of, I'd be that kind of person too if I had those elements in my life or if I thought that way. Or, you know, it just, you can't take it at face value. So I'm reading a book right now. Pretty sure the man is a reformed theologian, and so everything is in the form of a mandate or a rule or a law. It's over and over again the way that you look at relationships is you're commanded to love your husband, you're commanded to take care of your wife, you're commanded, and it's like,
sure,
man, that's lifeless if you're just seeing it in the, like, well, it's what I gotta do.
It seems to me too that we have to get to the point where we truly rest in the fact that we are taken care of by God. That we trust Him to the point that we understand that. That, you know what? I'm fine. I'm okay. No matter what happens, He's got my back. And then I'm able to look outside of myself and my own desires, my own needs or wants or whatever, and see, okay, the other person is where they need that too. You know, they have, I don't have to respond in defense or whatever. Because the temptation, I think, to get defensive about things is for fear of myself not being taken care of.
Yes, indeed. Well, God has lived out an incredible example for us, hasn't He? And so, His everlasting kindness and that hesed word is modified by this everlasting. Everlasting is a very assuring word if it's associated with positive things. not so much if they aren't desirable, but the kindness, the mercy, the compassion of God.
Both of those, I'm trying to make sure I understand that when He says everlasting love or steadfast love in 8 and 10, that's the hesed. But then when mine says compassion each time, that can be translated mercy, but what was that word?
Where is your compassion in the verse?
It's an overflowing anger. For a moment I hid my face from you, but with everlasting love I will have compassion on you, says the Lord my Redeemer.
Okay, the it's mercy in King James, but yeah, that's a different word. That's rachem. And it looks like it's got some similar face value. To love deeply, be compassionate. But if you, what's often helpful on these, if you, I don't know how many of you still have a working version of Bible Works, but there are certainly other Bible study programs that you can use. But so if you look at the Strong's number, it's 07355. What can be really helpful is to do a search on that number, so 0.073355, and look at all the passages where that word is used. And there's about 43 of them, looks like. And then you can compare that with passages that have the hesed and perhaps begin to get a little bit of feel for how it's used differently. Or is it just a synonym? I think that, at least among Bible scholars, the concept behind hesed is a special one that they note in studying the Old Testament. Okay. So, and then both of those words are used in both verse 8 and 10. In between, we have verse 9. For this is as the waters of Noah unto me. For as I have sworn that the waters of Noah should no more go over the earth, so have I sworn that I would not be wroth with thee, nor rebuke thee. Okay, so you remember in the flood, after the flood, that God said, I won't do it this way again. Never again will I destroy the earth with water. And so Isaiah connects to God's use there of that never again to suggest that there's something that has changed fundamentally in how he will deal with his people. And he says, I'm not going to do it this way again. For the mountains, he says in verse 10, for the mountains shall depart and the hills be removed, but my kindness shall not depart from thee. Okay, so some of the most permanent items in the environment, in the world. I mean, how often do you see mountains moved? not often. And yet he says it's as likely that that will happen as it will be for my love to depart from thee. Neither shall the covenant of my peace be removed, saith the Lord, that hath mercy on thee. So we saw at the beginning of this chapter that there was this strong intent expressed of assuring the people of God that God would be there, that God would save them from the shame of, the metaphor is, of being childless. All the things that they dreaded, all the things that beset them. And now he has, he's proclaimed that this is as certain as the mountains are certain, and the likelihood of him changing course is as unlikely as it is that the mountains be removed. He continues here to give words of comfort, using more metaphors. O thou afflicted, tossed with tempest, and not comforted, behold, I will lay thy stones with fair colors, and lay thy foundations with sapphires. I will make thy windows of agates, and thy gates of carbuncles, and all thy borders of pleasant stones. Okay, so we have to sort of put ourselves in a different mindset here. I doubt if there's very many of you ladies that have just dreamed of having your gates made of carbuncles. In fact, if you look up carbuncle, the most common usage of that word now is a physical condition, which is highly undesirable. It's a skin condition that involves infection, and you want to avoid that if at all possible. But it creates a very redness in the skin, and so this in the ancient language here, referred to a precious stone that was brilliantly red. And so that's, I guess, how you get in language from that to the skin disease. And, you know, it's language is funny, how we get places. When you discover a new condition that nobody's ever named before, and it's red, and it has kind of balls up, what are you going to call that, right? Well, it kind of looks like a carbuncle. And so from then on, there you go. But trust me, these are desirable things to have. To have a habitation that has been made attractive and beautified in this way was desirable, even though it may not connect to any of the images that you readily would desire in our world. And he says, "And all thy children shall be taught of the Lord, and great shall be the peace of thy children." Okay. Yes.
12 kind of sounds like Revelation.
Yes, certainly the stones bring to mind the pictures evoked in Revelation of the New Jerusalem. Indeed. And I think in verse 13, if we think about all that Isaiah is foreseeing here, the advent of Jesus to this world, where he takes on the form of man and walks among men and teaches. That's our new bell. Teaches daily in the temple and in the synagogues. I mean, literally, you have men being taught by God, right? What a blessed thought. Very well. Thank you all for your kind attention. We'll leave it there for now. Thank you.
Jesus.